From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2002 at St. John Fisher College. A student named Allie Larkin was taking a class in advanced fiction writing. Her assignment was to create a sentence using a list of words. Then she had to write for 5 minutes straight using that initial sentence as a launch point. Her sentence was, "Separation is a battle." For the next 5 minutes, Allie wrote furiously. What she found was that in that short burst, she created a character named Van that she loved. And over the next several years, that character remained in Allie's mind until eventually she decided she had to write something. Write a book about Van. And the book became a published work called Stay. Van, the central character, and it launched a writing career that has taken her book into multiple countries. The film rights for her second book have been optioned. The question is, how do you do this? How do you get fiction done? If you've ever thought you had a book in your head, how do you avoid distraction, especially with the modern world always trying to distract us, whether it's kids or the internet or email or something else? We have a panel this hour, our first Fiction Authors Roundtable, who's going to tell us about their process. We're going to answer your questions, and everyone's got a little bit of a different take, which is the great part of it, but let's run down the list. I mentioned Allie Larkin. She's the only one who's done it in the studio. It's because she's in San Francisco now, but Allie is on the phone with us. Allie, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Allie's the author of Stay, as we mentioned. The second book is called Why Can't I Be You? And Allie, congratulations on the success of both of those books.
Thanks so much, Evan.
I should tell our listeners, I've said everything that can be legally said about Allie's second book, Why Can't I Be You? Well, we can talk about the book. We can't talk anymore about the fact that the film rights have been optioned. They have, but I don't think what happens to you if you mention anything more? Did they come after you?
I think I just spontaneously combust.
Okay, well, enough has been said.
I think it's just something to keep on the down low.
That's no problem. Perhaps in the future we'll talk more about it, but the book is available now, Why Can't I Be You? Stay also available now. In studio, we have Alexi Zentner, author of The Lobster Kings and Touch. Alexi's come up here from Ithaca, and it's nice to see. Well, you're originally from Canada, aren't you?
Yeah, I originally grew up about an hour west of Toronto.
Very good, but from Ithaca now.
Yeah.
Nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sean Goodman is here. He's the author of Kindness for Weakness and Something Like Hope, and Sean is also from Ithaca. Nice to see you again, Sean
nice
Goodman.
Nice to see you, Evan.
Luis Wareham Leonard is here as well. Luis, the author of Since You Ask, missed me a lot, and I think that there's even more work coming from you soon, isn't there?
Next year, there's a book called 52 Men coming out.
52 Men.
That's right.
and Luis is from the Rochester area, yeah. Has done works with writers and books, and also does development work for other authors as well, don't you?
I do a lot of manuscript assessment and helping people to get something longer written and then edited. So
and try to navigate the difficult world of publishing, because we all
yes.
know it's not easy, and the publishing world's changed a bit, though thankfully we haven't eliminated print actual hard copies entirely, and I'm glad about that. What I want to do is I want to start by asking our panel a simple question, which is, how often do you write? How often are you writing? And I will start here in studio with Louise. How often are you writing, physically writing, fiction?
Ideally, every day from morning till about noon or one, and then I do business writing, editing other people in the afternoon. That's basically
That's your daily structured schedule.
Yes.
Okay. Monday to Friday.
yeah.
Mornings.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes if you're revising your own work, then I can write for like work for like 12 hours or something. But you've got to keep. For me, the most important thing I ever learned, which I learned really quickly, was if you don't carve out that morning time, which means foregoing full-time jobs, foregoing a normal life, foregoing all the things most people don't want to sacrifice, like have that extra half money of pay and your salary. If you don't make a way to carve out that time, you're not going to write. You're just not going to have time. So I was taught by, I think, pretty hardcore people about that. People were very serious about being writers when I was coming up, and I sort of took that on board, for better or worse.
Very good. Louise is one of the really, really effective dialogue writers I've read, by the way, and we're going to talk more about that later this hour. Sean Goodman, what is your process? And again, yours is a little different than the rest of the panel because of your work. Talk about your process.
Yeah, I don't have much of a regular schedule. I write in bits and pieces throughout the day. I work full-time in a high school as a school psychologist. I have two small kids, so I write for 15 minutes here, 30 minutes there. Sometimes it's in the car waiting for a kid. Sometimes it's in the middle of a meeting.
when you're ostensibly paying attention to the meeting?
I actually learned how to write when I was a psychologist for New York State working in the juvenile justice facilities, and I would get sent to the worst places for a week at a time for trainings, and the trainings had nothing to do with my work or interests. So I would sit and start sketching out characters and chapters. And 1 week training in Troy, I got 20,000 words of a sci-fi novel.
Wow.
And so that was really my training and how to write anywhere, any place, and tune out whatever was going on around me.
So Sean might be the single most effective person on the panel at tuning out distractions, which is going to be another subject coming up here. Alexei Zentner, what's your daily, or give me a sense for how often you're writing?
Well, I also like to write while Sean is working during meetings. You know, I started writing seriously when I was a stay-at-home dad, and I had two young kids, and I'd hired a babysitter to come in twice a week, 2 hours a week, and I couldn't really afford it. So I learned I really had to make use of that time. And now I'm in a really fortunate position where I'm a professor, I teach creative writing, and I write full-time.
So you teach creative writing
I teach creative writing at Binghamton University and also at the Sierra Nevada College Low Residency Program. But my job is to write, and I think that you have to treat it like a job. There's this myth of waiting for the muse to come, that you have to have the candles and the curtain and the glass of wine, and you have to wait for the muse to come. And the truth of the matter is that if you're not already at your desk working when the muse comes, it's too late, you missed it. So you have to sort of, as much as possible, carve out that space to write. And, you know, I'm lucky enough that that's my job now. But if it's not, you have to figure out, you know, I think Louise is saying there's sacrifices you have to make. And it's hard. It's hard to be a hobbyist and to be a serious writer.
Allie Larkin, you are a full-time writer. What is your daily schedule, or how often are you writing?
I'm kind of a binge writer. I spend a lot of time every day thinking about what I'm going to write. And I know there's a huge part of it that's just getting your butt in the chair too, but I find that I'm really not productive. I have a hard time sitting still. So if I force myself to sit still before I have anything to write, it's just a bad day all around. But I actually spend a lot of time walking around, listening to music. Like, I go for really long walks and listen to the playlist that I've set up for the work that I'm doing. Yesterday I did some lap swimming, and all of a sudden had this idea where it was like, okay, I can sit down and write this now. But I think because I have attention deficit disorder, and I think because of that, it's very hard for me to do this, like, okay, you're going to write right now. Because if my head's not in the game, it's just painful. But when my head's in the game, I can write for, 12 hours and come up for air and go, oh, wait, I forgot to eat lunch. which is always it's like a great feeling and a terrible feeling at the same time.
Now, this is the part of the panel discussion that's going to blow at least my mind, and I wonder if our listeners will be the same. I want to briefly ask, I'll start with you, Allie, do you type or write longhand?
I definitely type. I also occasionally will write out some dialogue longhand here and there, like if I just can't get my computer started fast enough. But I need to type, and I don't write in a linear process, so being able to cut and paste is a huge thing.
Okay. Louise?
I hate cut and pasting very much, and so I have deliberately, maybe in the last 5 years particularly, tried to go back to writing by hand the first
Amazing
draft.
Amazing to me.
Well, yeah, because it's if I've got the screen and I can read it and then go back and read it, I'll just cut it out and I'll just delete it. And I'm a big reviser. And so if you delete with a pencil, you can sometimes go back and say, oh, that was perfectly fine. Whereas if you delete with the computer, it's gone. So I really felt like, as a big reviser, someone who revises and writes really short, that I was putting a lot of stuff on the floor that might have been okay, and just making it more difficult than it need. You know, just get it out there, and then revise maybe later. Go back later. Try to get it out there. Then type it up, and then I second draft. Once I type it up, I don't usually go back to paper.
Okay, but your effort now, the intention is to start by longhand.
Yeah. Lately, yeah, it's the last 5 years.
Wow, Alexei.
Yeah. I type. My writing is just tortured and it hurts, but I don't know that it matters. I mean, I think whatever writing process works for you, I mean...
Well, that's part of the point here, Alexei, is that, like, for all of our listeners who think there's one way to do it, I'm amazed that we've got four authors on this panel who've had these great successes, and yet every approach is so varied, you know?
And I carry a notebook, so there are times when I'm writing things down by hand, and there are times when I don't have access to my computer. But, I'm slow when I write by hand, and I think I don't have the patience to write one word at a time.
And yet Sean Goodman is the guy... When I learned how you do it, I could not believe it. How do you do it?
I pay somebody to do it.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
None of us make enough money for that. I have a mild obsession with notebooks. I love notebooks. I've always loved notebooks. I have stacks of them in the house. So I confess that sometimes I go and look at them. I just like seeing them there. And occasionally I'll go through them and look at things I've written. And they're a terrible mess, filled with broken bits of stories and chapters and characters, grocery lists to do things for work. So they make no sense, but I carry one with me everywhere. And generally, once a year, I buy a $20 nice notebook, and in the year, I'll fill it with a draft of a new book. And when I get to the end, I type it in. And it helps me in a number of ways, because if you practice the thing of writing every day, no matter what, there's certain days when you just can't, you know, you're mentally exhausted or other things are going on. And when I hit those days, I automatically type in a chapter from my notebook. So I'm still working and I'm still writing, but I may not be creating. And when I get to the end, you know, these are 80 pages. And when I get to the end, I flip it over and write on the backsides, and then that's 160 pages. And usually it comes out to about one YA novel.
One young adult novel. So one notebook, handwritten, all the way to the back, flip it upside down, write all the way to the back again, and then when you're done, that's roughly a book.
And I don't allow myself to cross things out or rewrite. I just keep going, and it might not make sense some days, but I just keep going, and it's really...
At the time, but you can go back and revise when you're typing.
Yeah, but... While I'm working on a draft, it's just about movement. Just keep going. You know, it's like being the slowest, most out of shape guy in a marathon, and you're just set on finishing. You just want to keep going and cross that line. And everyone may have gone home, and the race may be over, but you're just going to get there.
You're going to get there. And we should mention, I chose our panel of our fiction authors roundtable today. Because I'm impressed not only with the quality of their writing, and I can tell you that all four are tremendous writers, very different, but the accolades that they've received are wonderful. I've had Sean Goodman on the program before. Sean's written a couple of books, Kindness for Weakness and Something Like Hope. After spending time in the juvenile justice system in New York State, Sean's books to me are gripping young adult books that I think adults should read as well, to get a good look at what realistically is happening inside our system. And your first book won the Delacorte Prize, Sean?
Mm-hmm.
The Delacorte Prize for the first young adult novel. Alexei Zentner. I mean, I feel like what I should do is just read chunks of reviews. But if you go to Amazon and you find their works, the reviews, Alexei, on Lobster, Kings, and Touch are fabulous. I mean, what is it like? Give me a sense now as an author, what it's like when all of that work goes into it, and you've spent months or maybe years wondering, will it ever get published? Will a single person ever read it? And you start to see the reviews that come in. The National Post, it takes some writers an entire career to write a novel like Touch. Zentner did it on his first try. That's outrageous.
Well, it doesn't get me out of emptying the dishwasher. It's incredibly gratifying. Writing is this thing where you sort of do by yourself alone in a cave, and there's this question of, you know, will anybody read this? Will anybody care? And to have outside voices say, no, this matters, is really helpful. But that being said, my experience has been that the more pleasure I take out of good reviews, the harder it is when I get poor reviews, because every book is a little bit up and down. And so I've come to realize that for me, the thing I really, truly love is not being an author, but writing. And I think there's a big difference there. Now, that being said, I'm as shallow and vain as anybody else. So, of course, I like hearing good things about my work.
You want me to read some more?
Yeah, no, yeah, please do.
Should I keep going?
For the next hour, actually.
We'll just read Alexei's praise. No, his books, The Lobster Kings and Tetch, beautifully reviewed. Louise, when you see the Westchester Journal say that Wareham is a bold, brave, first-rate writer, pitch, pacing, and characterizations are spot on, and her control of slippery, potentially explosive material is astonishing. You know, that's a tremendous review. It doesn't necessarily sell a pile of books. And at what point, Alexei touched on this, at what point do you reconcile the notion, I think before a first book is published, a lot of people who want to write think, if I just publish that first book, I'm going to be an author. It's going to be real. And then it gets published, and then you have to sort of have the next day and the next year and then the year after that. And so at what point do you look at those reviews and say, that means more to me than whether I sell 100,000 books? I mean, maybe your husband would like you to sell 100,000 books or 1,000,000 books, but how do you reconcile the great reviews versus the day-to-day struggle of, you know, just getting by?
I just think, I really think, talking about process, that it's not, that one thing people forget is that it's what you're trying to do for yourself. And sometimes my early work was very intense and dark, and it was aimed at, my hope was to share some knowledge I had of a very difficult area of life, which is like women, you know, sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse recovery in a fictional way, that I really felt I would hope that I would reach some people, that's all. I knew that my book wouldn't be popular with many people. And I knew also, so I was happy if I get one person on, there's one person on, I think, Goodreads who said it changed her life. I was like, wow, I reached one person, great. And then otherwise, it's really important to me that it's written well. So if I get control of it, I'm really into every sentence being as good as it can be. That's my personal goal as a writer, every sentence. But other works, it's like, you know, I'm writing something right now. 52 Men again is aimed at it's the writing's really important in it, so writers are probably going to respond to it as well as men and women on relationships. And then this new work I'm doing, Fiery World, is a fantasy set in the Arboretum where I live here in upper, you know, Rochester in Irondequoit. It's the most spectacular, beautiful, magical place, so I decided to write something that celebrated this and had fantasy in it, so it's much more alive and fantastic, and I think it will have a much greater reach. My agent's much more interested in that one than in perhaps sexual abuse ones, because of course it's got like Twilight-like themes. But I'm not doing it cynically, and that's why I'm happy with it. Because each project you do. To meet some goal of your own, personal goal. I don't set out to write a bestseller because I would be bored. That's a formula for me, or I'm just not that type of writer. But I do set out to make something to be the best it can be in its form and what it is. So I think Fiery World, I'm looking forward to every single person in the world reading it.
Louise touched on an issue that the roundtable is going to talk more about later this hour, which is what your agent may want versus mm-hmm. what you may want. If
exactly.
you have an agent, you know, how you get an agent. But Allie Larkin, we've been talking about, and by the way, Allie Larkin is on the phone from San Francisco. One of the reasons she's on the panel is she is a Rochesterian who only recently moved out there, and her books have a lot of Rochester ties to them, which is fun for Rochesterians to begin with there. But Allie, you were that student at St. John Fisher. You created this character, and for years it sort of stuck in your brain. How much as a writer do you find yourself caring and really investing in the characters that you create? And I'll start with Allie. I'd love to hear the panel's take on this. Do you get an emotional investment in the characters that you are creating?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yesterday, actually, I was coming back from the grocery store, and I had been writing and I earlier in the day, and I had a moment where I realized how two things connected, and I was just like sitting in my car crying at a stoplight because it was like, whoa, I didn't see that coming, you know. And my heart was breaking for this person who doesn't exist, and you know.
But you control it for them, Allie. You don't have to break their heart.
But you know, you do, and it breaks your own heart, and it's this weird emotional thing that sounds so crazy and kind of is. But oh my gosh, I care about my characters so much, and as I mentioned, I make playlists for each book that I write, and all these songs turn into songs about my characters for me. And sometimes after I'm done with a book, it's hard for me to listen to them again, kind of the same way that, you know, if you have a painful breakup and you had a song as a couple, you know, it's like it's hard to go back there because they're not quite mine anymore, even though they always will be a little bit.
And your readers have had, in many ways, the same kind of emotional reactions to those characters, haven't they?
I think so. You know, it's always really touching when those characters mean something to somebody else. And I also know that what, you know, what Van means or what Jenny means to somebody else is not the same as what it means to me, that they have their own interpretations. And I think that's kind of a beautiful thing when a book takes on a life of its own and a character means something to someone else. But it's also giving away what was secret and private. And that's a weird feeling, even though it's wonderful.
Alexi Zentner, author of Lobster Kings in Touch, do you grow an emotional attachment to the characters that you're creating?
I think you have to. If you're asking your reader to spend, you know, these 300 pages with these characters and to care about them and, you know, to present scenarios in which a reader is going to be happy or to cry over sort of losses these readers suffer, if you as a writer don't feel that in some ways, it's hard for me to imagine that you've created a character who's real enough that they're real for your reader. I think, you know, the best work are the kind of stories where when you're done for the reader for the rest of their life, it feels like somebody they've actually met.
Sean, in reading your work, I found myself gutted just getting to the end.
I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, I imagine you felt, well, did you feel that same emotional exhaustion when you finished?
Those were very personal books. Yeah, I felt compelled to write them, and so it was kind of a. Yeah, I've found this weird thing when I finish a book. Now I often get sick, like a cold,
actual physically sick,
flu or something like that.
You do? Wow.
And I never, you know, I never thought of writing as sitting in a chair. I'm often eating. I'm often drinking. There's nice, you know, it's very comfortable. But I think the process of, you know, spending so much time focusing and concentrating and trying to figure things out can be kind of emotionally draining, especially when the topics of the book are emotional. My big problem with characters now is quelling mutinies. I have this problem where my side characters almost always threaten to overtake the whole story, and they wanna to, you know, like steal the spotlight from the main character. And I'm kind of inclined to go there because I often like my side characters better and want to see, you know, what they have to say and where they have to go. But it doesn't work for the story. So for me, there's a lot of trying to figure it out on the fly, who the characters are versus who I think they are or should be. What Alexi often reminds me of, what he was reminding me of on the drive over here when we were talking about a book, what's best for the story, you know, what aspect of it works as opposed to, you know, what I think.
Yeah, are there moments where you will write a section or an entire chapter, a paragraph, a page, a third of a book, and you'll look back and say, this is a mess, it's not working, blow it up? Do you do that, Sean?
Oh, yeah. And when I don't, Alexi tells me.
You do. Alexi, do you do that?
I do, but there's also, it's not even, is the section a mess? Does it fit the story as a whole? With my first book, there was a section that I sold as a short story, and it's not in the book. And my agent's assistant, you know, he said, I love this. Why isn't it in the book? And I said, the answer is really simple. It doesn't fit the book. It doesn't matter how good it is. It's not part of the story. And I think that as a writer, the best thing you can do is to set aside, how do I feel, you know, what do I like, and only answer the question, what serves the story? Now, that being said, there are plenty of times I've written things that are just a mess. And, you know, that's a little easier to set aside because they're clearly bad. It's really easy to set aside stuff that's bad. What's hard to do is to set aside stuff that you love that you know isn't good for the story you're trying to tell.
But Allie Larkin, when part of the reason we wanted to do this Fiction Authors Roundtable was to give our listeners who might think they've got an idea in them a window into the world of people who are producing fiction and getting published, etc. And I hear from people all the time, I don't have time to begin with, and I certainly don't have time to write a lot of stuff and then have to go back and blow up a lot of what I've just written. Well, you transitioned to doing this full-time some years ago now. How did you reconcile the notion that occasionally you've got to blow up what you've created?
I think I've been blowing up my work for the whole time, basically. I think I wrote that book 7 times over. There's so much there that I know about my characters, and you learn things from the process of writing the stuff that you don't use. I just started with a writing group, and it was like 8 pages a week for group, and sometimes those pages worked and sometimes they didn't. And that made it easier to just get that feedback a little bit at a time. But a lot of writing is deleting. It's slashing kind of heartlessly the stuff that you've loved so much. I cheat because I save a new copy of what I'm working on every single time I go to hack away at it. So I feel like it's never really lost, but I pretty much never go back to what's been cut already.
And Louise, is there an end point to a book when you start? And will that endpoint ever change? Maybe the route to get to that endpoint will change, but have you ever found yourself creating a work of fiction and the ending itself changes for you?
The ending changes from what?
From what you set out with.
That's a tricky one. I don't think I can answer that one. Whether the ending changes. Some writers have the end in mind. And hit the end.
Yeah, maybe that's a better question. Yeah, maybe do you have an end in mind when you start?
I've had that if the story is a journey, like, okay, I'm going to go from an alcoholic, like what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. It's a journey. It's very simple. A journey is really simple. And a lot of writers, starting out writers, can say, what's changed? What was? What happened? What it's like now? That's an arc. That's pretty easy. I think rather than looking at a lot of beginning writers look at and analyze all these parts of writing, which you can do all day and all week, but sometimes it helps to just do, like, I like the idea of just doing a page a day. That I think someone was, rather than blowing things up, just doing, if you're starting out and you don't have the time and you're starting to write, and that's how I started. I started about writing when I really wanted to write. I was about 28, and I started in poetry because I felt there was no pressure on me personally, so I just wrote on Saturdays when I wasn't working, Saturday morning. And from then I started writing 2 hours on, in the mornings, or an hour just during the week. And from that I built up. But putting this huge pressure on yourself to complete a whole book, which, you can't have, back to the characters, you can write a whole book and realize one character takes over and is the best character and the others pale. So I have to help tell students, like, this character has overtaken the book, so what are we going to do about it? Can we bring the others up to that level of intensity?
Sounds like Sean occasionally has that problem.
That's what I was thinking. I'm referring to him saying that. Yeah, yeah. And I had that, and sometimes you think, well, does this belong in the book? I've had people say that. Well, this character here was phenomenal, so do you take that character out and make him into a new book, maybe? Or so it's it's endings, though. I 52 men, again, they can come with your structure if you do just stick to your, I have a 52 sketches, mm-hmm. which is short fiction. This was the process and the structure for this particular work that's different. And then there's a second part, which is one story in which the 52 sort of all have a different meaning, right? So that's an ending that I planned. And some people might say, well, the book could be without the ending, but that was came up, should we have the ending in at all?
Well, I'm late for a break. We're going to take the shortest break in radio. We're going to come back with our author's panel. And we're going to talk about how do you avoid those distractions? How do you go about the process of, if you actually think that you might want to leave work for this, and Sean Goodman hasn't even done that, by the way.
He doesn't need to.
But we're going to talk about all of those things. I should tell you that if you want to join the discussion, I've been rude as the host today. Here's the phone number if you want to jump in. I haven't given it. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI. It's the Fiction Authors Roundtable on Connections with Evan Dawson. We hear all about the Let New York Work agenda. Business and school leaders explain the reforms they're seeking to pensions, contracts, arbitration, and more. Then we'll debut our magazine roundtable. Rochester and the Finger Lakes have a diverse array of magazines, and we'll sit down with the publishers and editors to learn all about them and their local focus. That's Thursday on Connections.
Hi. How much are you willing to spend on a toy that helps your child learn to write computer code? Wait, you know what? Never mind. Kind of doesn't matter.
We can make you feel exactly how we want you to feel at a certain moment in time. I feel like such just a manipulator, you know? Just kind of like a magician almost. I've got all these tricks.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, manipulating minds by manipulating your wallet. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. It's our first ever Fiction Authors Roundtable and having a great time with our panel. We have Sean Goodman, the author of Kindness for Weakness and Something Like Hope. He's here from Ithaca. Also here from Ithaca is Alexi Zentner, author of The Lobster Kings and Touch. Luis Wareham Leonard is the author of Since You Ask and Miss Me a Lot Of. Also a couple new works coming, which we'll leave it at that. Allie Larkin's on the phone with us. She's the author of Stay and Why Can't I Be You? And we have a question from Alex online who said, I have two kids and an internet connection. No way I can ever get a book done. That's an interesting point. So that's a great place to start with the notion of distractions. Allie Larkin, you've said yourself that you have attention deficit disorder, which I know is challenging enough for an author. But give me a sense for what your biggest distractions and biggest barriers to being productive are as a writer.
I really have to shut myself off from the world to get work done. I have a very hard time transitioning from like one mindset to another. And once I can get in the zone, I think my ADD is very much an asset because I can kind of super focus on what I'm doing. But to get to that point, I have a hard time switching back and forth. So I don't answer my phone, and I am really terrible at answering emails sometimes. And it's not rudeness, you know, which is hard to get past, but I kind of need to protect myself and shut myself off so that I don't get distracted. You know, I don't have conversations in my head with people after the fact and things like that. I need my headspace to be about my characters. So I'm very protective when I'm in first draft stages of work, of what my input is, what I'm reading, what I'm, you know, how I'm communicating with people. And it's hard because you feel like maybe you're being rude sometimes, but you have to protect your work.
Alexi, biggest distractions and issues for you?
Well, I've got two kids, and you know, now they're a little bit older, and that's easier. But when they were younger, it was a real struggle. But I think, you know, one of the things I tell my students, my graduate students, is one of the first things I'll say to them in a class is that you're not allowed to say, I want to be a writer anymore. You have to say, I am a writer. Because the difference is that when you say, I am a writer, what you're doing is you're working. And if you notice, what Allie just said is you have to protect the work. Not the writing, but you have to protect the work. And it's really easy to find time to do your job. You can always find time to go work. But when you say, I'm going to go write, or I want to be a writer, it's a hobby. And you need to put yourself in a space where you can commit to doing it, where you can say, this is important enough that I will carve out the space. And it's not easy. It's not easy for anybody. But I think the only way to really make it work is to not give yourself the safety net of allowing it to be something that you're trying to do. It has to be something that you are doing.
Sean Goodman, you're a little different on the panel in that you have a full-time job, and so you're writing during your actual day-to-day job at times. And you're also, it sounds to me like you've done a very good job of learning how
My employer's going to love hearing that.
No. He's a great school psychologist. But you've done a great job of tuning out distractions. How do you, are you just, that's your personality? You can lock in on things?
A roundabout answer, but I promise I'll get there. For me, one of the great things about becoming a writer has been getting to know other writers and observing and talking. And one of the things that seems common to all of the professional writers I know is that they're really compelled to do it, period. And I know before I became very serious about writing, you know, I had the questions that you hear over and over again, how can I find the time and will it be good enough? And there's lots of others. But essentially, I don't think those questions matter. I think they're the wrong questions. And maybe people should try not to write and to do whatever else they want to do or whatever else they are doing. And if you're going to do it seriously, you really have no choice, and you'll find yourself compelled in lots of different ways. You know, you may buy and savor notebooks, or you may find yourself wandering to the writing section of the magazines and Barnes & Noble or in the library, or, you know, scratching things on napkins and in stray pieces of paper. So I don't know. I think for those of us that do it, it's, you know, it may be morning or night or here or there, but we're going to do it no matter what.
Louise, when you are writing, again, your structure has you writing in the morning up till about lunchtime. Do you have to disconnect from the internet? Do you find distraction at home?
Well, I was writing before the internet even came in, that's for sure. And that's a whole nother. I actually really like the internet. I mean, it's like having this incredibly live library right there, you know, so I can just. So I'll remember, you know, to check something later. But it can be distracting, of course. But I don't know. I feel like when this person writes you and says, "Oh, I have two kids and I'm distracted by the internet," it's like I was just get back to that. The novel, the book, is such a big thing in people in our minds. So if you can just say, "Okay, I'm just going to do one page a day, one notebook page a day," as we've learned from Sean. At the end of a year is 365 pages. Now, that's a long novel. It might not be any good, but it's you've written it. And I think taking those, I have a client who's writing a book. She's very high in the medical field. She's fully committed to her work. She's a psychiatrist. She's very bright, and she's got a fascinating story. And she's like, "Well, how can I write it?" And I'm like, "Well, we're going to get you to write your story, your memoir or your story in scenes. Just write me three scenes a week and send them to me." And so we have already a fantastic collection. It's coming together incredibly well because she happens to be making the time, and she's compelled to at this time in her life. I don't know. Maybe she's in her late 50s. I'm not sure, but... she's got the story, and she's just taking it piece by piece. And luckily, if you can afford to work with somebody else, it can help me with my first novel. I mean, just put a pitch in for the help of a coach, if you can get that. But you don't need it. I didn't have one, you know, most of the time.
I admire the fact that you view the internet favorably and can work alongside it.
I can't. I have to. It's a battle. It's a battle.
I remember
what I love and hate it.
My favorite writer who passed away a couple of years ago, David Rakoff, said that. He always found himself, when he quit work to become a writer, he found himself wanting to check email every 48 seconds.
No, email, you know, and just, Facebook.
It's amazing how fast you can get distracted.
Email and Facebook are the culprit. The internet is a live encyclopedia, but Facebook kills me.
get out of it.
I can't get out of it.
An email from Sasha wants to know, would the panel mind talking about how they decided they could afford to quit work and make this full time? And again, every person on the panel is a little different. I'll start with Alexi.
I sold my first novel. It sold in Canada and the U.S. and ended up selling in about a dozen countries. And at some point, I realized I could financially afford to quit the job that I didn't have, which that made it easy. So I just graduated from graduate school, and I had no employment. So it was easy to afford because I was making $0 before I sold my book. But it's being a writer is a weird thing because you don't get paid every 2 weeks. One of the things I like about being a professor now is that I get paid, and then 2 weeks later they pay me again, and then 2 weeks later they pay me again, and it never stops. It's amazing. And as a writer, it's really it's a hard process. But I think most people, I think writers make more money than they do, and unless you're writing really popular fiction, the vast majority of writers also teach or do something else to help them make a go of it.
And Sean's in that category. Sean, have you thought, your books have done, to my eye, they've done beautifully well, they've been reviewed very well, they're held in high regard. Have you thought about leaving your work as a school psychologist to write full time?
I guess you could call it a 5 or 6 year plan, and I've just been doing things very gradually. So I think after two or three years of writing seriously, I knocked off one day from my 5-day schedule, and that's what I'm doing now. And in another year or two, I'll probably knock another day off. And so each book or two will cut down my. So I'm kind of writing my way out of my full-time job. But the job in and of itself was part of the plan also because I work at a school, so I have summers off and I get school holidays off, and I'm also done at 3:30. So I have chosen a career that has some built-in time for writing.
Yeah.
Although my kids keep threatening that because as they get older, they're around more. So I used to, I used to have mornings and after school. Now they're there. They're always there. They're always there.
Two words for you, Sean. Boarding school.
Summer camp. As Sean Goodman knows, there's a few summer camps out there that might be a good place for kids. Allie Larkin, I'm sorry, Sean. Allie Larkin, when it comes to your decision to write full time, how much do you want to share about that decision for you? I mean, every writer's different, but you decided that I know you loved what you were doing, and you were doing so much of it anyway, but tell me about your decision-making process.
You know, I think it's important to note that it wouldn't really be possible for me if I weren't part of a two-income family, because there is that lack of regular paycheck, you know, and you do have to kind of constantly keep track of that. There's a lot of trying to live underneath your means significantly and keep things simple, because you don't necessarily always know when the next contract's going to come in, and it's not, you know, it's not regular money, and that makes it hard to plan. So, you know, it's a hard decision to make. I sometimes miss having a full-time job, though. I think it was, there was something about sneaking writing in, something about it feeling subversive. It felt kind of delicious in a way, and I miss that a little bit. You know, sometimes that huge expanse of, I should be doing this, I should be writing, I should be, you know, it's not necessarily easier in some ways. You know, and in some ways it's obnoxious to say that because I have a lot of time to work. But I have less structure, so I have to find the structure myself, and that's sometimes hard.
Louise Wareham Leonard, how do you make it work?
Well, I was a writer. I was a news reporter from age like 15, ridiculously, and 17 and 18, and worked at Time magazine at 20. I was really, you know, on a upward spiral until I crashed, right? No, and then I quit, and I was a senior editor at a luxury magazine that flew me around the world, you know, to resorts and on fancy boats. So I was doing pretty well by some lights, but that wasn't what I wanted from life.
It wasn't a good fit for you.
It wasn't. I mean, now give me back that job, and maybe, you know, I might be tempted so I could go to Greece and the Caribbean again, but I figured, oh, I'll become a writer and I'll go back there on my own steam. So I'm sure that's going to happen really soon. But no, I didn't want to be a full-time journalist. I wanted to do my creative work. So sitting at home on Saturday morning or Monday, there was just always this pressure that I wanted to have my own work to do. So I took the plunge, and it is a plunge, and you take the pay cuts, and you go from 55 to whatever, to 20,000 a year, or 14 or 18 or whatever it might be. And I did. And I also, I have to say, I didn't want to be a full-time writer that went into an MFA program, became an assistant professor, and did the tenure track my whole life. I wanted to live. I wanted to have more to talk, to write about.
Alexi, what's wrong with the tenure track?
It's a really wonderful way to live. I love teaching. I like being part of the classroom.
I wanted more experience. I read all these. I read for Tin House. I read all these poems of students sitting around, like, well, staring out the window. What will I write about today? Memories of their childhood. It's just, they don't seem to have had any jobs. I mean, I've worked for an investment bank. I've worked for a seminary. I've worked in the outback of Australia in an Aboriginal mining town. I mean, and I've paid the price for all of those experiences, and I've never had the income that I had. And, you know, right now I'm teaching, and I mean, I'm not saying it's not a great profession, but you've got to. Yeah, some ways you're right. Your adolescence is enough suffering for anyone. That idea that a writer is fully born with all the experience they need. But on the other hand, I'm glad I'm not one of the 5,000 people out there in academia. I mean, I wouldn't mind doing it now, but I'm glad that my life actually had some different experiences to offer that aren't purely out of my imagination.
Alexi, are you feeling a little wounded over that?
No, I'm doing pretty fine in my career, so I'm not real worried about it. And I also think that, you know, the beauty of being able, like, if you're a fiction writer, the whole point of being a fiction writer is being able to move outside of yourself and write about what you want to write about. And I think that, yeah, I often say to my undergraduate students, take some time off before you go to graduate school. And I did. I was 32 when I started writing seriously, and I'm 40 now.
But he's not a full-time fiction writer. He's an academic and a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. This is the difference. So you're not, when you
Except
ask
that,
about
Louise,
full-time, only very few people are
full-time. You don't actually
full-time.
Know me, and for several years, I was a full-time writer for several years.
For several years,
teaching.
But right now, I was
and
just
right
talking
now,
right now.
As of this year, I started the 10 track because I enjoy teaching, and I missed it. And I found that for me, writing full-time didn't allow me for the energy of writing that I also get from teaching.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about you specifically. I was talking about the widely discussed debate about MFA programs and people going in at age 21 and not having real jobs. That's what I was talking about, not living in the world.
real job is sort of a debatable term. But see, what we're seeing is not all published writers think the same. And I think that's a...
The ivory tower of, you know...
It's a very healthy
part of grading and critiquing each other's works in ad nauseum, you know.
Does everybody in this on this panel have an agent? Lexi has an agent?
Yes.
Sean?
Yes.
Louise?
Yes.
Allie? Okay. Allie Larkin, I'll start with you. When it comes to agents, do you find the push and pull? Because when it comes to becoming, you know, an author, whatever that means, sometimes it means going, and often it does mean going through the process of getting an agent, and that can be sort of a frustrating process, etc. But when you do have an agent, they're supposed to advocate for you, or at least I think that's what they're supposed to do. Do you ever find a push and pull between what you want and what they want, Allie?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that an agent's, you know, an agent is going to want your work to be marketable, and that's not necessarily where your heart lies. You know, like, I think that that is totally a push and pull, and, you know, what my solution has kind of been is that I just need to write what I need to write, and you know, I certainly care that people want to read my work, but I have to love it myself. That's the important part first.
Alexi, do you ever have a conflict with an agent?
I'm very fortunate that my agent is, he's very much in the literary fiction world, and he only cares about the writing, which is wonderful because it's nice to sell books, but I really care about the writing. And every time I ask him a question that has anything to do with the market, his answer is always some version of, what does the story need? And I've been very fortunate because I don't think that's always the case.
Yeah,
So I feel very lucky to have that.
Is there a sense, Alexi, that, and I'm probably dumbing this down, but the notion in popular music that mm-hmm. you can write great music and sometimes an agent will say, you got to write me something with a hook, or a label will say, we're not going to put it out there unless there's something that's easily pop hooky about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's difficult about literary fiction is that my first book is impossible to talk about in one sentence. Which makes it really difficult to sell.
Semicolons help with that.
Yeah, right, right.
You can get a lot out of semicolons.
And so I think depending on what you write, I mean, it's there are certain novels that sell easier and certain novels that win awards, and they don't always overlap. And I actually happen to be writing a very commercial novel right now because it's fun. And one of the things I like about it is that I can actually, it's a work in progress, so I'm not going to really talk about it, but I can describe it in one sentence. I think my agent likes it, and one of the things he likes about it is it's fun and it's easy. But with the literary stuff, I think ultimately when you're writing literary fiction, the most important thing is sort of the truth that comes out of it, not the sales, which is why literary fiction doesn't necessarily sell as well.
Sean, any conflict with an agent?
No, it's been a good experience because whatever idea I have that I want to pursue, the green light is always on, and so I only have to struggle with myself, not anyone else. It's just up to me to talk myself into or out of, and then back into certain ideas or projects.
Louise, any struggle with an agent?
My agent is very. Huge agency in New York. I initially joined my agent when she was on her own and she did literary fiction, and then she joined with four other agencies, and now they're huge and they're massive. And I do feel that they no longer serve literary fiction very much. I mean, my agent, you know, so when I go to her now, but it's just a matter of knowing your market, and I think writers have to know their own work. So like, I had a work that I'm saying, will I give this to this agent? I gave something to her and said, you know, this is not for you. This is not, it's not commercial enough for you. So in that case, no, you know, I'm not going to go, don't present your work to somebody who's, you know, isn't interested in that kind of work. So I went to a literary small, you know, smaller press, and bang, they were the right place. But another work of mine that I know that my agent will, you know, can do something with, I'll go to her with that.
We're going to close our authors roundtable with a couple quick questions from listeners. Brian online wants to know how much these authors actually read for pleasure. Alexi, how much are you reading for pleasure?
All the time. I try to read every day. I mean, I think most writers come to it because you love reading.
Sean?
Yeah, I still think I'm a reader first. I think the writing comes after that. I don't know that I could write without reading.
Louise?
All the time. Love the Rochester Library. I order in holds to my local, you know, local library. Pretty much anything you want to get, with literary exceptions, you can get. It's fantastic. I really read a lot of experimental fiction and foreign fiction. There's just great work that we can get at the library now.
Allie Larkin, how much are you reading?
I don't read a whole lot when I'm working on my first draft of something, and then after that, it's like I can't get enough, and I binge read really crazy amounts.
I've got about 90 seconds left, and we had a couple questions along this line, so 15 seconds each. That's ridiculous. 20 seconds each for all of them. Just a quick thought for anybody out there listening who says, I think I got a book in me, I've got a full-time job, or I've never done it before, I'm intimidated by the process. Alexi, what would you tell people?
If you told me you wanted to run a marathon, I would say start jogging and work your way up to it. If you tell me you want to write a novel, sit down and start writing. It's word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph.
Sean Goodman.
Cool. Go for it.
You'd say cool. You'd say do it.
Yeah.
Louise, what would you say?
I'd say break it down, page a day, scene a day, dialogue a day. Character a day. Just write something down every day.
Allie Larkin.
Let yourself write badly and then go from there. But don't stop writing because it starts to come out bad. Everybody's first drafts are embarrassing.
That's probably good advice. And great stuff from this panel. Allie Larkin is the author of Stay and Why Can't I Be You? Out now, available, and she's a Rochesterian who's now out in San Francisco. Great to talk to you, Allie. Thanks for joining the panel.
Thank you so much.
Louise Wareham Leonard, the author of Since You Ask, Miss Me a Lot of, Fiery World, 52 Men, among other things. Nice to see you, Louise. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Sean Goodman, welcome back to Connections. Nice to have you. Kindness for Weakness and Something Like Hope are his books, but there will be more.
Thanks, Evan.
And Alexi Zentner is the author of The Lobster Kings, most recently, and Touch, and as we've mentioned, lots and lots of praise, which Alexi doesn't mind hearing, but the praise has been phenomenal for the works. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Evan.
Great to have you. Thank you for the time. Thanks to Roger behind the glass. And maybe what we'll do is we'll come back and we'll do another Fiction Writers Roundtable for November. I've never done, what do they call it, NaNoWriMo or something like that? But a lot of people do it. We'll have fun. We'll touch on some other subjects and we'll come back around then. For now, I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections, and you've been listening to member-supported public radio.